bad leaders are everyone's worst nightmare, giving you the ultimate playbook to lead, inspire, and grow your team. Better Tech Leadership, powered by Brainhub.
I'm very glad that you joined me today to talk about legacy. It's quite a broad topic, we can agree. We can just look at it from different perspectives, but let me start this conversation with a very simple question, but a very important one. How do you understand a legacy, and when does it become a problem, in your opinion?
For me, legacy becomes a problem when you have some business requirements that become very costly to implement. So when you actually expect to invest a specific amount of money on software, which is money and time, and you have a certain set of conditions that prevent you from being fast at delivering that business value. That's in general what we, when we talk about legacy, is usually a software development effort that takes longer what it should because of the current systems that are actually there providing some value already. But this kind of change of direction or change of requirements is basically like preventing you from going fast.
Yeah, I love this answer. It's very close to my I just see it as a change that is quite hard to do so. And let me know, what do you see as the major reason of appearing legacy in product development, in software development? How do you see this? It's like it's a technical problem, or maybe it's somehow related with business value or business requirements. How do you see it?
I think mainly because developing software is very difficult. So it's not only about coding. Actually, that's a mistake if we think that developing software is only about coding something. Well, that's part of it. It's an important part of it, but it's also stakeholder management, expectation management. Usually software is developed as a team. There are different levels of experience in the team when they develop software. And also is risk management. Like when you develop software, you need to somehow set up a balance between developing something that is going to be, I mean, maybe not bulletproof, but that at least is going to, if there are some requirement changes, and there are always requirement changes, at least to do it in a way in which you know more or less what kind of changes will actually fit well with the system design that you have at this moment. But on the other hand, you shouldn't go into over-engineering something, so putting too much complexity to handle a problem that is not there. So this balance between what is actually fitting the current requirement and also the implementation that is going to prevent likely requirements from coming is what is very difficult. And that's why, in general, you see legacy systems 1 month after they are developed, and other legacy systems maybe years after they are developed. So that varies a lot. That's mainly the problem I see, that balance, seeking that balance and managing that balance, not only from a coding perspective and a technical perspective, and also from a non-technical perspective, so that you can earn merit, so that you get investment and time into basically defining the system, into managing the expectations, so that maybe something that it looks easy to do in 1 week, you actually need 1 or 2 months to develop it properly because it makes sense for the business. This is the complexity. And that's why this is so difficult. And that's why many companies, if not all, struggle with this. We all struggle with this.
So do you have any recipe to find this balance? Do you find any practices, methodologies that help you a lot?
I think experience helps a lot, because you can have all the good practices, but I've seen, for instance, cases in which you, as an engineer, focus a lot on those good practices, and that blocks you from developing something. And also the fact in which you want to iterate fast, and which is also important. You want to have fast iterations to production to get feedback and shape the product, especially in a startup. That's what usually happens. And then you notice, oh, if I would have done this before, I would have actually been faster. And then all this pain that you experience through hundreds and hundreds of iterations when you develop software all through these years in different type of teams, different company sizes, personal projects, team projects, freelancer projects, projects when you are a CTO or leader or whatever, all these kind of different types of projects and all those learnings and all that pain because you actually thought, oh, maybe I should do this, but I don't do it because this is faster. And oh, well, actually it was slower. All these learnings and just challenging yourself and your team with all these things that don't work as expected. That's, I think, the best recipe. The problem is there is not like a methodology that I could give to you that is going to solve this problem because, of course, I could talk about agile or test-driven development, a lot of nice things, but it's not like going to be a solution. Test-driven development is, for instance, very powerful, but it also has some problems. You need to have engineers who know how to test. You need to have engineers who are productive at testing and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, there is no recipe, but it's true that these best practices or common good practices help. But at the end, engineering is a craft in which you have patterns, you learn the pattern, you learn the concept, you learn the abstractions, you basically learn those basics and you know how systems work or how things work under the hood. That's engineering. And then as an engineer, based on your experience, the real recipe to solve this is, when do I apply those patterns for this specific use case, for these problems that we have in the legacy? What kind of constraints do we have? What kind of battles we want to fight? What actually does make sense for the business in this moment? All of this is the actual recipe to deal with legacy.
Yeah, to fully understand the problem that we are solving, actually. Because some people are thinking, okay, I'm just coding and I'm just trying to modernize stuff. But it's like, okay, there is a business value that we need to deliver. So it's really important. Then we need to understand what we need to do. And you said we need to have a lot of experience. And yeah, I agree a lot. It's like sometimes we jump into a project, into a code, and it's like even on subject level, we can determine that there is a part that we need to change to deliver something. And it's quite obvious for us, for technical side. But then there is this business side. And how do you find justifying such modernizations to the business side? How do you convince them that sometimes something needs rewriting and needs time just to make things easier in the future?
One thing that helps a lot is, metrics are powerful and are also dangerous, but businesses want to move fast. They want to definitely be faster than the competition. And showing the problem in a way in which the business understands what is actually at stake, it definitely helps to move forward with this kind of projects. So with a modernization project regarding a code base or a system. So, for instance, if you have some metrics that are showing that because the system is not modernized, that it's difficult to find engineers so that you can grow, or, for instance, you have a big problem with the reliability of the system, and that's actually something that you can tie to not modernizing certain parts of the system, or that is taking a lot of effort to maintain those things while there is an alternative that would actually reduce that effort. And you can show that with metrics and also with the investment that the business is going to take on this project and the return of investment. And this is actually more in the management side, but it's an important thing to do. And you know, that's what managers should do, and you need managers to shield the team from all of this. They need to facilitate those resources so that engineers can actually work on that and that this is aligned to what the business needs. That's basically what helps to bridge expectations from the business side with the reality in the engine room, that is what's going on with this legacy system that is so annoying to maintain and that at some point might cause an outage that is going to cost a lot of money to the business. And this is also something that more or less you can mention. Like, look, we had this SLA and then this is actually our uptime, or this is basically our latency, and this is how much it's costing us if the service is having a latency of more than X, or if the service is unavailable like 10 minutes per day, and this is actually like we are not very very far away from this, and we can see a trend that is reaching that availability percentage, we are going to lose X money for every minute that the system is down. And that basically shows a strong message. But that requires, I mean, that's also like a full-time job. So, but it's needed. And then the business really understands, because we are talking their language. If we talk about refactoring, yeah, because this library, whatever, or yeah, this is technical debt. And if we repeat all these things all the time, they will disconnect and they don't understand. They will say, okay, well, they are basically like going again with their jargon. And I don't know exactly what we should do that makes sense from a company perspective.
Yeah, exactly. I really love this example that you put at. It shows perfectly how we can just easily convince people, business people, because it just translates to money, especially. And lots of people think that, okay, we should measure quality or just legacy by metrics, of course, metrics, but they are thinking about technical metrics. And for example, they may think about, I don't know, measuring it with SonarQube and or any code quality measures. Do you find them useful, or is it like we need to translate it always to just this business value, this how a business can get just more value from it? How do you see using any, let's say, this technical side tools? How do you see it?
I mean, so for instance, regarding static analysis like SonarQube and so on, I find them relevant for engineers. I don't find them relevant for the business. So, yeah, I mean, great quality, but at the end, what they want is to have systems that work, that they are easy to maintain, are cheap to maintain, while they are available and not causing a disruption, so that the business doesn't lose money and that we can do new features fast. That's everything that matters. And then you can see that the quality is already linked to this. Like, if you have quality systems, then you will actually have more reliable systems. You will be able to manage the risks better, and also you will be able to develop fast on them. So this is kind of like the incentive. So the goals are totally aligned. But regarding SonarQube, I find it very interesting also from an engineering perspective, to get better at coding in a specific language. That definitely helps. I like to have this kind of static analysis tools helping engineers, giving automatic feedback as part of a code review, so that it's not always a person doing the review about, hey, look, this line, actually, you write it in a different way. Then, you have a bot doing this, then the reviewer is not all the time repeating the same. They also don't like to repeat the same thing 1 million times. And also the one who is reviewed, the reviewee, is going to be more open because it's a bot. So they are not going to argue with a person. It's the bot, and the bot says this. And this is the community. And, you know, this is a community of experts who are giving some guidelines about how to code in this language. And then everybody's learning. For this, SonarQube and these kind of tools, Deep Source or whatever, they are very interesting. Also, we shouldn't really get super fixated with being perfect with them, because I already have seen a code base that is perfect with these metrics, but I think that it really helps. And then, as a consequence, when you have people, developers, who are aligned on how to code in a similar way in the code base, following these good practices, then the code is easier to understand, the code is easier to read, then they feel that they are learning, which is also aligned to their career goals, because they want to grow as engineers. And then automatically everything goes together, and the quality of the code base improves, and the developers are happier, and if developers are happier, they are more productive, and this is basically kind of the thing. So how do you measure that? But, you know, it's at the end following these good practices that are not new, that open source teams have done remotely for years, then has a result. And the important thing is, we do an action or a certain set of actions, and we have a good result. Then, yeah, for that, I don't really set like specific metrics, unless there is, I don't know, for instance, a code base is in a really bad state, and we actually need to focus and see that we don't get really into a black hole, so that we know when to stop. Then actually, that's where I put this kind of metrics. But in general, not definitely for the business, I bring other different metrics.
Yeah, I see. And We spoke about experience, about metrics, but what would you suggest for engineers, how to learn deal with legacy? Of course, it's just gaining experience. It's quite obvious, but sometimes it's like some people will say, okay, you need to just write clean code. Some will say you need to just that's very simple actually. Some will say that you just need to put some practices into action. Some will say that you need just learn architectures, design patterns, and so on. How do you see it? It's like what is the best career path that engineers should follow to understand legacy and to understand business value that they're trying to deliver, to learn faster and to learn and doing better things? How do you see?
Yeah, there is this clean code thing that has become very famous lately. I mean, all these practices are good. In general, I mean, for instance, the clean code movement, what you can read in a book, it makes sense. It makes total sense. And I think it encouraged developers to follow that. But the reality is a bit more complex than a book. So at the end, with legacy code bases, it's not like you are going to read the book, I mean, the clean code or microservices or all these. I mean, you read them and then you understand the concepts, but every legacy code base is different. Like, also the context that you will have in that company and the culture and the people, I mean, everything will be different. So, and also, you have experience in some legacy projects in the past and how they went. I mean, you, like developers who went with microservices, or they tried service-oriented architecture, or they tried a monolith. I mean, all of them had different learnings. Then you will actually be able to see the patterns about what kind of mixed approach, because it's usually never black and white. You kind of like figure out a specific set of approaches. You strangle the code base in some way so that, I mean, in some cases, it's better to just destroy the previous code base and start a new. It really depends. Then you will be in a better position because you already have that base about the good practices. You also have the experience about what you have seen in the past with certain techniques. And also you have the experience dealing with people and with the culture in that specific company in order to basically move along with that project. So regarding this, it's not only about the good practices. That's a part of it. When you deal with a legacy code base, another important thing is what kind of team you have, what kind of company you have, what kind of culture is in the company, also the resources that you have, and how important the legacy system is. All these factors have to be valued. And then once you put everything together, you will actually know from all these good practices and the clean code and et cetera, what kind of techniques to do. Because sometimes, even if I want to write like clean functions or to basically like write perfect code, at the end you will see that, well, you have constraints. And then you will understand also the constraints that the people who were working in that code base have, because you are actually trying now to do the same. And then you know, then you see it's not black and white. It's like people want to do dirty code. Like at the end they have a lot of different constraints, and also even if they do clean code, requirement change. And maybe 1 year, that clean code has to be changed in some way, and sometimes clean code can be super complex, and then it's difficult. So it's like there is a whole range of things to take into consideration that is also important.
It's just like this famous, it depends.
Yeah,
it's, basically. But it's very important. You've said that what is important is context, and there is no just one path that is right. It's like you need to adapt to every project, every client, every team member. When team membership changes, rotates, it's like it's not the same project anymore. And you need to deal with it, and there is no one major practice that is right. It's like it's a tool set. You need to figure it out what works.
But there are patterns. I mean, I sad to say it depends. Yeah, it does. But it's also true that there are patterns and there are things that in general will work for most legacy code bases. And then based on this, you actually can detect what it makes sense, then you know which practices to apply. Like, if we talk about testing, because I think that we all agree that if you have automated testing, this is going to scale much better and it's going to give you more confidence into making new changes. Maybe, you know, sometimes it makes sense to focus on unit testing, but sometimes the legacy code base is so, it was written without testing in mind, and then doing unit testing is very difficult or almost impossible. And then you actually need to maybe do more end-to-end or just figure out some integration practices or whatever. And, you know, like, there are different different approaches that you can use. In general, I will tell you, like, if you have most of the code base covered with unit tests, this is great, because you will be able to do refactors blazing fast. And then, you know, you maybe can do the tricky cases with integration. And then at the end, if it makes sense, you can actually do some end-to-end. And then if you start with this, this is kind of a recipe that will always work. But this recipe might actually not work in certain legacy systems, because if you actually follow the recipe, you are going through a path that is going to bring you a lot of misery. So that's why I'm not so keen into giving a universal recipe, because then we'll be, oh, this guy who is saying that, let's do unit tests. I mean, well, maybe in that specific case, there would have been other approaches and other battles to fight. That's basically my point. But we can also put examples and elaborate some cases, and maybe that helps.
Yeah. And it's many people, especially young people with less experience, think that, okay, let's say we have patterns, design patterns specifically. And it's like, okay, so if once in a time someone described them, it means it should always work. And then jump to the project, especially a legacy project, and then you see everywhere strategy commands, chains, visitors, and so on. It's like, oh my God, what did you do? And they are, because it's working, because someone said that strategies are good and they are using it everywhere. And what it came in time is like they didn't understand why they should use some patterns in what situations. It's like, okay, it's a good tool, but in some certain scenarios. And this is what they didn't understand. And that's why the content is very important. And I would jump to a little bit another area, because it's also related to especially young people. It's like new technologies. And new technologies and legacy is like, it's very, very hard balance. It's like, how do you see implementing new technologies, especially, I would say, not simple libraries and so on. It's like completely changing, adapting frameworks and so on into existing legacy products. Do you find such, let's say, big migrations possible, or how to adapt some such changes, how to justify it, and how to implement it? Have you ever done something like this, and what is your opinion in that area?
To implement, for instance, that you have a legacy system, and then you would like to integrate, I don't know, maybe like a new library or a new software provider or something like this. So how to plug this in into the legacy system, you mean? Or
yes, because sometimes it's very hard to justify whether it will help you or it will bring value. And many people sometimes like new technologies that they, okay, everyone is using it, it's just new, let's use it. And how to justify such a thing? And it's very hard from my experience. Sometimes it's quite, in some cases, it's quite even obvious. But in some cases, like, oh my God, I have no idea at all. And how to approach such a situation?
I mean, this is I really like this question. Sometimes I'm really into state-of-the-art technology or libraries or frameworks or approaches, because sometimes you see some signs that something is going to stick. It reminds me when we started with Kubernetes a long time ago, and then it really helped us to manage the containers, and also we didn't have to change to a different orchestration framework, because that actually won. But, you know, imagine that we go with another one, and then we actually need to migrate because it's not supported anymore. So that's actually kind of the risk. When you jump into new technology, sometimes you are a bit like in the casino, and you need to be aware that if you get that technology dies, or that is not having as much momentum as you thought, well, you are going to have yet another legacy problem. So on the other hand, there are also some technologies that what I call boring engineering, and they are very stable. They solve a problem a long time ago, and they are still solving the problem. You don't see many changes, but what they do it very well. And that's when I often refer to the Ruby on Rails ecosystem and the Django ecosystem. They have, you know, people will say, oh, this is very old, whatever. But, you know, they still have a lot of support. They are very stable. You are not going to find surprises. So you know that if you rely on this, it's going to be rock solid. And also, it doesn't mean that you are going to be old-fashioned or something. So some cases, I actually, one example could be, we are working in Python, like there are really new fancy ORMs, but at the end, you go to SQL Alchemy, and this has been there for ages. I mean, I was in the university, and we were doing SQL Alchemy, so like, well, that was a while ago. And so this makes perfect sense. It has a lot of tooling. It has evolved very well, solving the problems that we want, giving us a good balance between maintainability, flexibility, you know, these kind of things. Like, and that's not new technology, and it works. So I think that a mixture really depends, again, it depends on the case, but sometimes it's worth to take the risk because it's enabling your business, for instance. One example could be when we were very small. It was in a healthcare startup, and we had the requirement to do mobile development cross-platform, and we didn't have native development people, and having like hiring iOS and Android engineers, well, it would have been very, very difficult and costly. And we had kind of like experience with Vue.js, and then we at some point did investigated some technologies, and we decided to go with Flutter. That was at the very beginning on Flutter. And well, Flutter is definitely having a lot of relevance today. So it would have been also a good play to go with React Native, and it was also new at that point. So sometimes these risks pay off, and this is when you go with a new technology because it made sense, because we had some skills in the team, and we had a technology that was enabling the business in a way in which it made total sense. Then I will say that's where technology leaders need to evaluate all of this information and be unbiased and make the decision that makes more sense to the company. And well, we are not magicians and we don't know the future, but we can prevent risks. So at least let's prevent the risk that we are very confident that we can prevent. And that's actually when you can go and take more of a risk. I hope that's an example of let's go with new technology and with conservative technology, you know, you also can do refactors or basically like enabling the business using the well-proven rock-solid technology that has been in the area for ages. Maybe you just need to update to a major version and, you know, to find a way, but that also is important. I mean, that also has a fit.
Quite interesting. One thing that came to my mind, which sounds a little bit stupid, but it's like a technology leader is actually like a businessman that is like in a casino. You need to take a risk sometimes. It's like sometimes it's worth it, and sometimes it is better just to stay with safe technologies because you don't need to just make some decisions just to compete the market more or something. And it really depends. And it's quite interesting how, in fact, technology, the tech side and business side are really connected to each other. And what I believe is like every previous engineer that's is starting basically with code. But after a time, it just comes to this place like when it's like more, maybe not businessman because it's not like that, but he really needs to take business into consideration. He needs to take risks. Mitigation into consideration. It's like, okay, should I choose this technology or not? And sometimes it's like a bet. Let's agree.
A bit like poker, maybe, not like a lottery ticket in which, oh, let's see what happens. That would be bad. But like, you know which hand you have, which is kind of the resources. And then more or less, based on your hand, you know what kind of action are you going to do. And you know that you can't predict what's going to happen all the time, but you basically have the experience and you can read the room and read the market, and based on what you have in your hand, then maybe you can basically make some decisions that might be or usually are, should be on spot.
I really love this comparison. Yeah, it really looks like a poker game. You need to just understand your environment when you are, and it's not like I'm just using statistics and so on. I need to read the market, people, and so on. So it really works like this at a certain point of time. Yeah. I really love this. It's amazing because I've never thought about it like this. It's like I'm aware about business value. I'm aware about risk and so on. But in comparison to poker game, it's just amazing for me.
We can do role games. You know, you go with a character and he has level 1, and then you go to a dungeon with level 10. Yeah, well, maybe that's not a good idea. But if you actually like are leveled up, you have a better chance to be successful. So that's kind of, I mean, we can find many analogies. Yeah.
So let me ask this. I've already asked very similar questions at the beginning, but I will ask it once more. Do you see legacy results more from technical or business side, in your opinion?
I think both, because in general, often a legacy system is a system that is paying the bills. So often businesses are going to be risk averse about making changes in the stuff that is making money. So you often don't see businesses like Microsoft saying, okay, look, well, we are earning a lot of money with the Windows licenses, but let's screw these licenses and let's go to the cloud and everything is free and we just bet on open source and we just go full kumbaya for somebody who would actually be like this kind of thing. And then, yeah, you know, they switch the business and well, I think it's giving them really good results, isn't it? So you often don't see businesses like that. And sometimes it's needed. Like, well, we have a system that is paying the bills. And that is making the company successful, but the company could be the victim of their own success. So in that regard, that's definitely in the business side, because everything that is going to happen, also regarding the system, while it's an engineering problem, the incentives and the resources are given by the company. So this is a decision that is global in the company. So if there is a problem and at some point these risks are not managed and the system is down and we are losing money, well, it's definitely the engineering department problem. But often there is more to it. If there is attrition in the engineering side, there is more to it. I mean, so that's basically like the business problem. And then in the engineering side, is going back to the topic of the balance. And also how difficult it is to deliver quality at speed. Also, how busy usually people are in an engineering department. And usually, it's very difficult to prioritize what is important. So a lot of things are going like a kitchen sink into engineering. Especially in a big company, you can see that people who are having connections and who are friends from some engineers, they kind of push their own agenda to them. They know how to use them. And then you try to put some layers to actually get some focus to reduce the work in progress as much as possible so that your department can do something. And this is something that usually you actually always see when a company is growing. This is a problem that leaders have to manage at some point. But the other thing is that balance is very difficult to keep. So a good benchmark would be how fast a system has become legacy. And this is kind of a benchmark where you could actually evaluate the maturity of an engineering department or an engineering team. If they have a system that started very fast, but then very quick, the amount of features that they were very fast at developing features at the beginning, but then after a small amount of time, they are not. That the balance was completely screwed. Like the balance was, okay, let's do it fast. Oh, actually we reach a point in which we are the opposite. This is really like, and this is a very big problem to have to manage. So that's basically part of the engineering side. It often in engineering, it is very counterintuitive. So one example with the test, and it happens to me as well, to be honest, I'm testing like, and I start with a prototype. Usually with prototypes, people would say, don't write tests. Then at some point in general, the prototype is successful, it will go to production. I mean, do you think that you didn't have time to write tests? When that prototype is going to become production, that you will actually invest time in putting tests, and that's actually where you are going to commit a mistake. Because the time in which I push myself to achieve that level of automated regression checking in any kind of strategy that you might want to put, when I managed to do that, I was like, wow, this was a good idea. Maybe I spent, I don't know, a few days or 1 week to actually do this. I was disciplined and I did it. And now I can chill. Now it's like, oh, everybody's surprised because I'm able to develop fast. Like, how are you doing it? Everybody wants to actually, hey, what is your freaking secret? Well, the secret is basically like that kind of discipline. And you can be the best developer in the world, that if you don't have that discipline and you actually like, you don't push yourself to do this and to have that balance in check and to know when actually you should pick that fight, then you are going to be in a complete loop of pain. And that's actually purely engineering, because also the engineers need to show the context about, hey, this feature that you are putting, they have the power to say how long usually is going to take, or they have the power to manage the deadlines, to manage the expectations and to push back. And sometimes we engineers don't push back. We just accept what it comes. We get into this dead march of a delivery date. And then we just ship with shortcuts and then you are screwed. And then fixing this, the longer you wait to fix this, the worse it is. And then there is a point of no return.
Yeah, it reminds me about one my situation regarding legacy and velocity of team members. There is one great law that explains measures. When a measure becomes a target, it gets to be a good measure. It's a Gotthard's law. And what it means is like when we put a wrong measure, we can end up with a very bad result. For example, if the faster we deliver a value, the better at the beginning. Yeah, of course, junior developers are the best because they can simply just put, they're not just writing and it's working. And senior developers, for example, it was slower. And after time, just appears that, yeah, because senior developer had to just figure it out, how to do it properly, how to just put it into context of this business value about the future chances and so on. And he just constructed it properly. Why the other guy is like, okay, I'm doing fast, slow, and extremely slow. And what happened? It's like, yeah, because there was a bad metric. And some people, I think, don't understand that legacy, it's not, okay, you can measure it partially with metrics. They are useful. You can agree they are very useful, but you need lots of interpretation. And you can just use static code analysis. You can just use time to market measures, some of those delivery measures. And it's very, very dangerous path. And you sometimes need to believe those engineering guys with some experience that if they're doing something longer, it's not like because they are, I don't know, lazy and they just doing some stuff that nobody understands. No, it's like just figuring out how to make it properly so in the future there is less pain, basically. So we can just deliver faster in the future and be just better, have a better code quality and so on. And I try to explain it to my delivery manager, and it was like, oh my God, I've never thought about this like this. It's like, I think that it's like just writing you just as fast as you are, but it's not. It's like, you need to sometimes put some of effort and just to make the feature a little bit easier. Have you ever a situation that you had to explain this to some business guys about this technical side, like some of metrics and some of velocity issues are not related to, for example, less experience. Sometimes it's even in reverse. It's like it's more related to bigger experience and making even some solutions for a longer time. It's not like we're just doing it slow. We are just doing it better. Have you ever had such situation to explain it to some business side guys?
I mean, definitely, because sometimes they have a point in some cases, like they want to push some features and they don't understand why this is slow. And then it's the common thing, like that I hear in many places, like engineering is slow. And this is kind of like, well, if engineering is slow everywhere, what is the actual problem? I mean, You know, it's like engineers suck or something. I mean, there are certain constraints. So on this, well, mainly what I like to do, especially with high technical things, more bring results than to actually explain, hey, look, well, yeah, this is what we do in software. Yeah, the unit test, automated test, also, you know, we iterate short. So we need to deploy often to production in short iterations because we have more feedback. I mean, when I see interest in knowing how all of this works, I always super happy to, because it also helps me to try to explain this in non-technical words. Like, and actually some parts are intuitive if you explain, like, why in software often we see that teams are waiting to push all the things in bulk, and then you have a huge pile of changes that you are going to deploy, and then you deploy. So this is what usually happens. But then it's like, well, but don't you see that if you actually like do it bit by bit, the risk that you are going to break things is smaller, and the actual thing that you are going to be able to fix this faster if something goes wrong. Like, you are putting all your culture towards this very tiny concept that is, let's ship early and small with small things, and be something that you can do. Because if you basically shape all your culture towards this principle, like, this makes things better, and it's something that everybody understands, but still it doesn't happen because it's difficult and because, but you know, these kind of concepts are easy to explain. The thing is not about explaining them. The thing is about giving results, about implementing them. Because, you know, we can be talking about, hey, the deployments, continuous delivery, la, la, la. Continuous delivery, like, is always depending a lot on the company and the type of project. Most probably, we don't want continuous delivery. We just launch a satellite. But maybe we want continuous delivery with a web application. So or like, that's kind of like, it really depends. So on these... those concepts we explained, but I think that the important thing is to basically show the results and put work in explaining what was behind those results, because then you earn merit. And when you earn merit, it will be easier for you and for your team to basically push all of this forward. And this is actually the reality on every company. If you are new into a company, it's important to earn merit so that it's going to be easier to bring your philosophy because you are showing results. And if you just start and pick some battles without bringing the results, you are going to easily burn your philosophy for that company. So I think that has to be aligned. I think that also in some cases, you don't need to fight. Like, you can always manage a deadline. And if you think that in that deadline, you can make a lot of improvements in the system, do it. I mean, you are going to achieve the deadline. Who cares? Like, you are making things better and you are delivering. Negotiate the deadlines in order to make things better so that it's going to put you in a better position for future deadlines. And then automatically for all those iterations, everybody will see, oh, look at the last year. So this technology leader with whatever that person is doing, I mean, whatever that person is doing is doing it right. So that's already setting you the merit. And because those results are there, and because you are always constantly improving things. And if you know which battles to pick, there will be like a small constant improvement. And then, well, it's important to also sell and to give visibility about the things that you are improving. Metrics, hey, these are the metrics that we had before. And now after this year, because we did boom, 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 this project and this project, look, now we have this. And we are able to do this. And now we are faster at doing this. And that's also the management work that has to be done. Because if not, you improve things, but nobody noticed. so that doesn't really help towards your earning merit.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking about context, there is something what is really important as well as communication, because it really depends on business context. For example, I had a situation that we just pushed a feature and we tried to cover it with tests later. Like not in TDD way, but just at the end. And our client said, no, there is no time for this. We need to deploy it as fast as we can, but we don't even know whether it's properly tested. Yeah, but he said, we just compete the market. It's like, it's very important thing for Israel now because market is becoming so competitive that there is no doubt. We are aware about what tests are and why they are good. But this is not the time. And sometimes the problems, I think, appears when when there is no communication, there's that set. What are those contexts? Where there is a vision sometimes, a lack of vision. People do not understand why we're doing things in a certain way. This is what really needs to be implemented properly, not even a team, across an organization, across a product organization. And sometimes I think that this lack of it, and people do not understand context, why they're doing things this way, not the other. Have you ever seen like the problems of communication that also just generated legacy, or is it like sometimes maybe sometimes communication is the just the solution, that when communication is proper, everything just becomes easier?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And especially the bigger a company is, the bigger this problem can be, and the bigger the impact. Let's just one example. If we go to a team level, when we plan for the development of a product, what I call the iteration churn. So imagine that you have an iteration of the product that you plan in some way, something. But you know that when you go actually to the code and you are in the implementation phase, you are like, hey, look, we need to throw this entire day away. Or you implement a project, and then after the project is implemented and it's live, it's like, we need to shut it down, which happens relatively often. That's super expensive. That's actually the thing that has to be prevented at all costs. And that's actually kind of also counterintuitive, because especially with companies that have a startup mind, even when they grow a lot, it's very difficult to basically like find a way to plan those products so that you prevent this iteration churn, or you prevent shutting down the project. And this is a multidimensional problem, because when a company grows, you need to set up a mission and vision so that the departments can align to this, so that the departments won't be competing with each other, and that you can distribute the budget in a way that makes sense. And then for the departments, in general, you know, the bigger the company, the bigger the department is, or could also span multiple regions, then you need to somehow align all your teams that are or could be distributed towards the goals of the department that are aligned to the goals from the company, and then in a way in which you want to have knowledge workers that are not micromanaged and that are going to independently work towards where you want them to go. And this is extremely difficult, this kind of steering and this kind of exercise, to express this strategy in a way that everybody is going to understand, in a way in which they also will feel that this strategy is theirs. This is definitely a challenge, because then you could also generate legacy with this. Because already when you shut down a project, I mean, well, it's legacy that you cut down. Or even you start a system design, and this happens with companies like the startup of startups. For instance, where you have, and this is a big problem in big tech, you have very smart engineering teams, and because everybody's so busy, they don't help other teams. They don't really like say, okay, look, what I'm doing here, let's make it, you know, it's because it's a lot of effort. Let's make it available. Let's actually, like, if another colleague has a problem, I'm going to help them so that they can use what I did. Instead of this, the teams actually close into a bubble, because it makes them faster. But overall, and this is what actually a leader of who is having the context of all these things, they are like, what the hell is going on? They are so unproductive. We are reinventing the wheel every single time. This team is doing this. This team is doing this other thing. And this is doing the other thing. And then you see that they are kind of doing the same all the time. They create their own authentication. They create their own whatever, their own deployments, their own blah, blah, blah. And then that's actually where you see, well, if we find a way, and this is actually the job of a leader, to find those cross-cutting concerns in a way in which this will optimize how the teams work with each other. And you set a culture in which, you know, they are helping each other in some way without killing their productivity, makes the entire company much better. And, you know, all of these also align to the vision that we discussed. And then you will prevent creating legacy projects, because imagine that four teams create their own authentication system. Well, maybe, you know, three teams didn't have experience on this and create a lot of, you know, we need to destroy that legacy because it has a lot of vulnerabilities. We do a pen test and, well, oh, look at this. Oh, actually, well, this is legacy. You need to maintain this. But then we will have prevented the legacy if we had this in place. If we had actually a team organization that would already cover that cross-cutting concern so that other teams can benefit from this. And this is kind of like another way of preventing legacy, basically.
Yeah, exactly. It's like this company level, what I would say, it's just clean design, how they communicate and avoid, for example, duplications even, because if any team does develop something and any other can use it, why not? And that's the role of leaders, just to make sure that it happens a lot. Yeah, I really liked it because not many people think about it that, okay, we think about modules in a code and the modularization, the composition and so on, but it also works on compiling in teams between people and so on. So any concerns or the solutions should also just go through the company and we should help each other. So that's why I said that communications sometimes is also the thing that maybe sometimes many people just forget about it, how it is really important. Yeah, I think that we can just jump a little bit to summary. We talked a lot about legacy. It's like, it's a rabbit hole, actually. I believe we can talk about it for hours, about different scenarios, examples. It's like, there is... every project is different, every team, every client, and so on. There are no duplications in that matter. And there are so many different perspectives how we can look at it. It's like we can see this from tech side, we can see from code side, from business side, from people's side, and so on and so on. And in every project, it's completely different context, different environment. And at the end, I'd ask you to give one recipe for engineering, especially how to deal with legacy, or what is the most important thing that they need to look at just to compete legacy.
So to basically, I think that first of all, the most important thing is what do we want to achieve with this project? I mean, what is the high level goal? So could be that has to be clear to everybody. Sometimes a legacy could be due to regulatory. Hey, we need to split this because we want to have a special regulatory for this part of the project or what. Or it could be something regarding a risk for the company, like we can lose a lot of money. It could be because the company is slower and they want to revitalize their tech stack. And then, based on that goal, what has to be assessed is how realistic it is with the resources that we have. And if we need to find new resources, how to get them. So that has to be clear. So based on this high level goal, the company, one example, we are slow. Our competition is fast. We want to be faster. Great, we have a high level goal. Then you have a range of systems. Okay, what systems can actually like, would make more sense towards achieving that goal. And then you prioritize kind of the system. Like they can look at, okay, look, we have a priority of systems that we can actually modernize. So we can actually like work in some systems at the same time, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these things have to be clear because the business goal has to be always in mind for this kind of modernization project. And then based on that, you start splitting and create a kind of a small roadmap. Like, well, I mean, how long is this going to take? Because the legacy systems could be a project of 1 year, five, three months. What kind of legacy are we talking about? Like, could it be just a module and then it takes a few sprints, or could be a huge modernization project in 1 or 2 years? You know, an example for this could be moving to the cloud. I had several of those, like from on-premise, and even the other way around, moving out of the cloud to on-premise. That was also kind of one modernization project. All of this is like, What is the time frame? Expected time frame. You also need to manage the expectations with the business on this. And then more or less you have the resources and time frame, and then you start to go to the specifics. Based on, you try to do it in a way in which you have some flexibility, because the longer that you plan something, the bigger the flexibility window is or should be. And that's something that, because you can't plan everything in software. And then based on this, like, you can maybe take a look at the quarters and say, okay, well, quarter one, discovery of all the dependencies in this code base. Because that's actually one thing that we didn't discuss about, and this is always the same. If you want to modernize a code base, you need to know the code base. You need to go through the code base, know everything that the code base is doing, all the dependencies, what problems is it solving, how coupled it is with the code base itself and with external services. All of that has to be super clear, because if it's not clear, you will find it on the way, and that might be already too late and I can't really change the scope. So that also could be, for instance, the discovery phase. Then after the discovery phase, more or less, you should already have a rough idea of how you want to start with the modernization project. I mean, what kind of patterns do we want to apply? And this is actually where engineering comes at play. What patterns from all this range of patterns are good practices? Which ones do we apply now or later? You know, which actually, what is kind of the order of this? And that's more into the implementation phase. And then in general, there are also different techniques depending if you do an A/B or you are struggling a code base. Like, you kind of like, you do a green and blue in which you destroy it and then you have the new. That depending on that is, you have kind of like a rollout mechanism. Maybe that rollout looks like something that you do like bit by bit, or maybe at some point you have like a big test. I'm not a big fan of this, but sometimes it's needed. You have like a big test period in which you set an alpha community or a beta community or something, and then you are actually earning trust in the system. You know, this is kind of like already when you are in the implementation and you are close to reach the end of the legacy part, when you actually consider the legacy project done. This could be kind of all of these steps that are kind of generic for all the legacy projects that somebody could lead, had to be super clear.
I would say it's just like to make sure that you have the clarity of the context, entire full context of everything, not just the tech side, but everything.
The business, the goals that we want to solve, also what the system is doing, why is the system doing that, what problems the system is solving, because you also will need to solve them. All of this is, it's usually where engineers underestimate those systems. They, we can refactor this in a few, whatever. And they're all weird. That's actually very tricky and very dangerous. If you go to a system and say, we can refactor this in whatever, and then actually, like, you find things on the way, and then have fun trying to explain all the investment that was put on this, like, well, you are losing merit, you are losing trust from the business, and that's not ideal, because at the end, in engineers, we are enablers. What was that book, The King Makers or whatever? I mean, like, you need to enable the business, and we are solving this kind of complex business challenges with code and with good system design. And that's the main principle in general in a profit organization, basically. So that has to be aligned.
Yeah, exactly. At the end, we need to bring a value, business value. Thank you very much, Dario. I really enjoyed our conversation today. We covered it a lot.
Better tech leadership powered by BrainHub. Follow Les Schick on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Better Tech Leadership newsletter.